or good evening, depending on where you are in the world. And welcome to Information Week Live. I hope that everyone is having a great week. We've got a great episode lined up for you today. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin. And joining us today, we have someone that you're used to hearing here on Information Week Live, Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt.
We've also got a new voice here. One of our contributors at Information Week is joining us. We have Larry Loeb coming in with us here at Information Week Live. Larry, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you very much, Kurt.
And it is entirely possible that a bit later on we will have another special guest joining us. We're hoping to get the always popular Sarah Peters to join us in a bit. So we're going to start our discussion on any topic except the big one. So we're going to hold off on our discussion of whether there is anyone left in the United States whose information has not been stolen by hackers, probably from the Chinese government, and talk about a couple of other things, because it's been an interesting week, and I want to launch one topic. I wrote an article this week looking at modern versions of COBOL, and
yay,
I have been absolutely stunned by the level of discourse on what's happening with COBOL. I mean, there's just been a ton of conversation. Should I have been surprised? Dave, let me start with you. Were you surprised to see all the people who wanted to talk COBOL?
Well, you're probably asking the wrong person, because when I hear COBOL, I think about science fiction. I'm not actually surprised for this reason, which is that we know that a lot of enterprises have a lot of things that are operating that are there because we know they work and because there's no reason to fix them or change them or modernize them. They just work, and we know that they pay consultants large sums of money to keep those things working rather than trying to get them to go from scratch. So the great thing about COBOL is it's tried and tested for decades, and it works, and we know how it works. So I'm kind of glad on a certain level that we still have so many people interested in it, because there's going to be a point very soon where we're going to need somebody under, you know, the age of I'm not even going to pick an age because I don't want to insult anybody, to talk about this and work with it and fix it.
Now, Larry, I know you and I have had brief conversations about COBOL recently, and for all of its wonderful history and advantage, there are some issues with COBOL. And so from your perspective, is it a good thing that there are still so many of these applications out there that are running on a basis of COBOL?
Well, it depends on what you define by issue. I've always found one of the features of COBOL that I appreciate is the simple readability of things. It's Grace Hopper's legacy that she left readability as an integral part of the language. It doesn't execute as fast as some other languages. It's not as elegant, but it's a language first language I ever made money off of doing, and it has a big place in my heart just because of that.
Well, I think that the readability issue is one that we can't really minimize, because I know I've had the experience of being asked to come into a team and help them debug, And when the language in question is something like C++ or Java, it can be a while before I really get a sense of where they're going in the program. I mean, because let's all admit it, programmers don't comment. Programmers hate putting comments in line with their code. They either they're under too much pressure for time, or they just don't think it looks elegant. But either way, you're left with code where you really have to start at the top and walk step through it line by line to figure out what's going on in a lot of cases.
Now, wait a minute. You have to do that with COBOL too. I've done way too many register jumps on JCL programs, but I have some idea of what to look for, you know? Because of the readability, the fact that, and even more than that, the fact that you have to define your data structures explicitly. You have to have them out there for testing. You have to have them out there for execution. And that feature of the language is also quite, quite important, in my mind anyway. Just because when you do those horrible register dumps, when something's going wrong, at least you've got an idea of what to look for, where to set your trip points.
Well, that's very true. And I think this is the point at which we could very easily start trotting down the rabbit hole of strongly typed versus weakly typed languages, because they do require you to have those clues, those breadcrumbs up top, so that you do have an idea of what you're looking for as you go down through the code.
Yeah, I think it was to me, in any case. I don't want to close myself out as the perfect programmer, though I indeed may be, but it was just something that allowed me to figure out what was going on. Plus, there's so much written in it, it's easy to have a career for the rest of your life. I think if I ever wanted to gouge someplace just simply doing something for money, I would hold myself out as a COBOL programmer and just maintain that bank stuff till it dies.
Well, talking about maintaining programming, I think my next big language piece is going to be something on where all the Fortran programmers go.
I'm still here. Wait a minute. I'm still here.
Well, before Dave and a certain portion of our audience fall asleep, I think we should probably shift our attention away from development languages and towards something that may actually affect more people. Our colleague Kelly Jackson Higgins had a great article this week on the fact that Microsoft Office is now fully available on Android devices. And so this means that Microsoft Office is now fully available on both iOS and Android devices. And so my starter question, and Dave, I'm going to wake you up to bring you back into the conversation, is whether we are entering or have arrived in an era when platform just doesn't matter.
Well, before I answer that question, I believe that was Kelly Sheridan who wrote that article. While both are wonderful people, I think Kelly Sheridan's our Microsoft expert and Kelly Jackson Higgins is our security expert.
You are quite correct, and my apologies to Kelly Sheridan. This will teach her to be too busy to show up on Information Week Live.
Well, no, I didn't mean to criticize. I just wanted to help people find the article when they go looking for it. So does platform matter? Yes. Does it matter to Microsoft? No. Microsoft, is starting to come to the realization that it is a software company, which is something it probably has always known. But it has decided, quite correctly, that the days of 90% market share for Windows is gone. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't make billions and billions of dollars writing good software. And where 90% of Windows users might be gone, 90% of Office users still has a chance to be true. They still have a good dog in the Office fight in comparison necessarily to the mobile online front. Although I'd like to point out that I'm actually a big fan of Windows 8, and I think I'm looking forward to Windows 10. But we're never going to get back to where they're a single dominant force, and that's okay. Microsoft can make lots of money. We're at the point where, as a user, we ought to be able to pick the best application for the best job and not worry so much about these things, and that's okay.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Windows 10, because a lot of the shift to other platforms happened, let's admit it, as a result of Vista. And so my question, my follow-up question is, could it be that Microsoft is going all in on the platform free plan at exactly the wrong time? That they are enabling people to go to Windows Office on other platforms at precisely the time that they are finally releasing an operating system that everyone might want to move to?
Well, I don't know. Everybody seems to universally think that Windows 7 is a pretty darn good thing, and Windows 7 didn't stop the move, so the exodus or whatever you want to call it. So I'm not sure that matters. But, you know, we do have a long tradition of believing that every other Microsoft operating system is good, right? And so 8 was the most recent problem, and 10 is going to be good. I don't know if that's a true thing or just a sort of a belief that people like to have. But I actually think that from the point of view of Microsoft, specifically Microsoft, this doesn't matter. I don't see them being able to go from 4%, I believe is the last recent market share they've had in mobile, from 4% to some large number. I just don't see that happening. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they should be fighting harder for that. But I just don't see that happening in the next, say, 5 years. So why not make sure they stay dominant in the places they're dominant while they try to get a bigger beachhead into mobile? I don't see a problem with that. And the great thing is if they do start winning the operating system wars again, that's no problem because people are still going to be using Office. If they try to hold Office only onto Windows and hold tight to that idea, then if they lose, if they never gain the big market share back, somebody is going to make an Office equivalent that people will change to on Android and iOS. So I think this makes perfect sense.
Okay, Larry, I'm going to turn over to you and ask you a follow-up question on what Dave just said.
Sure.
First of all, Dave said, if Microsoft doesn't release Windows for a platform, someone's going to come out with a Windows or an Office alternative that they can use. How about all those great Office alternatives out there? Is there any one of them that has a snowball's chance in hell of gaining real traction?
I think LibreOffice is probably best of breed. I personally use it routinely and do not find a need to have any Microsoft licensed products. Of course, there is a critical mass about Office as far as data format exchange. If you can get your data into something that's readable by coworkers, you're fine. If those coworkers need Word or Excel or PowerPoint, then you can use something like LibreOffice on a number of platforms, and it will work. And by heavens, it's free as well. Of course, they'll take your donation, but they will give it to you for free. I personally find it quite useful. There have been some other very clunky attempts at this. And if you like alternatives that are okay but not as full-featured as some of the things Microsoft does, they're fine. For 80% of what I do and what I think a lot of people do, you don't use all those features. I mean, Word was the originator of the term featureitis. And I think that's a real problem, both in the code and how fast it executes.
Well, you know, I agree with you about the functionality. And let me say, I currently have two versions of Microsoft Office, LibreOffice, OpenOffice.org, and the Apple Office productivity products, all on my system. And for what it's worth, I find that I use none of them regularly. But the question
And by the
that
way,
I have,
go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, the question that I have really is about whether the issue isn't so much features and functionality as it is training. You know, a lot of people have said that they are going to Windows 10 and had considered Windows 8.1 because they put the start button back. I am consistently surprised by the number of people in the workforce who learn how to do things by rote. And if even the smallest change is made to a menu or an interface, it renders them essentially non-productive in the workforce. I mean, have we reached a point where in the same way that you have to get into an automobile and find the steering wheel in front of you, the accelerator on the right, the brake on the left, that Microsoft has just defined the user interface so completely that nothing else can compete in the enterprise?
Users get used to things that they're comfortable with. Unix administrators had magic formulas, so it's not just low-level users who do this. All computer types have their own magic incantations to get things done. I think that's pretty typical. The point is, how much can you change it and still build on what users have already come to learn? Apple went through this, for example, with a number of applications as they changed and evolved. If you haven't used Pages forever as a Word replacement, it can be very daunting, just as Numbers, their Excel replacement, can be, even though they provide a file compatibility option, they don't work the same way. You have to learn different things. There is a learning curve. If you're paying somebody $10 an hour just to input, they won't learn it. Even if they do learn it, they'll mess it up. I'm sorry, that's a generalization, but it's true. The most of the users in the workforce that are out there using this stuff don't want to learn it. They don't care about the computers. They're just going through their jobs and doing it. So, if you change something in any major program they have to use, there are going to be productivity problems.
I think there's a bigger issue here. I think it's the Android phone specifically, but also other movements, have changed expectations towards customization. So one of my favorite things about the Android operating system, and one of the reasons I hate the iOS system so much, is how customizable the Android phone really is. So that if you took me and any other Android power user on a phone, and I consider myself to be a pretty wily user of Android at this point, our phones wouldn't look anything the same. Even if we had the exact same apps, we could have the same 50 to 100 apps on our phone, but we would organize our pages, our widgets, our icons entirely differently. We would use the phone in extremely different ways, right? What Windows encountered to me with the start button wasn't just resistance to the this is the way we wanted it before, but the idea of we want this to work the way we want it to work. We don't want it to work the way you're telling us to make it work. We live in a day of mobile apps that allow us, even with iOS, as much as I want to make fun of it, to create a custom experience by the apps that we choose, by the way we choose to encounter the mobile internet, right? When you're talking about Windows, they're still trying to create a desktop experience where they're pushing a user experience onto the user. When Windows becomes flexible and customizable, and it started to a little bit with Windows 8, but hopefully it's going to be more so with 10, the more flexible you can make it, the more you can design the user experience around your own brain, the better it's going to be. And I think that's the big change that we're seeing.
Well, and I think you've just made the argument for why IT departments worldwide hate things like BYOD.
Yes.
Because the more things are standardized, the easier it is to support an entire fleet.
Right.
And the more customization is out there, the harder it becomes.
Right. What we need to do is make the user experience flexible, but the back end predictable. That's easier for me to say than it is to actually do it. But that's what we're really talking about here, is creating an experience which is understandable and flexible for the user. But once they're done pushing their buttons and it goes back into the IT back office, wherever it needs to go, it all looks the same to them.
Well, you know, that's one of the great arguments in favor of virtual desktops.
Exactly.
The IT department can have everybody on the same version, can control which apps are available through central servers, and then people can change the layout as they will. Larry, I know we've been hearing about virtual desktops essentially forever. And for the great mass of, you know, we'll call it information workers, white-collar workers, if you will, they're still quite rare. Do you think they will ever catch on, or are we ever going to have a point where everybody's doing stuff on virtual desktops?
The desktops may be virtual, but I think what's going to end up happening is what Apple is getting ready to push out for iPads and things like that in the workplace, which is a basically automated configuration of every device. They have a tool called Configurator, which can set up an invisible administrator account, download apps from the App Store, put in any secret strings and URLs you want put in there, so that afterwards the desktop, as you were, or the screen top, is aligned the way that the IT department wants to receive it. Now, you can then go and play with it to customize your individual brain function, but the way it works has been standardized to a great degree. I think that the real holding point for working this way is people trusting cloud storage for business documents, and that's a very valid concern. There are all sorts of ways that cloud storage can be either corrupted, analyzed, hacked, that if you physically air gap your laptop from all of this, you've got a better security platform. But yes, it's going to be possible. But the way it's going to be done, in my opinion anyway, is pretty close to what Apple is trying to do here. That's their secret weapon for saving iPads from irrelevance. They're going to make it so that your boss can give you one, and your boss will feel okay with it.
Well, this is one of those things where I think we're in this evolution, but it's an evolution that's been going on since at least 1990, as far as I know, and it really shows no signs of slowing down to any significant extent. Well, before it gets too late, we need to turn our attention to everyone's favorite article of the week, and that is The Geek End. And, Dave, I'm afraid you got all racy on us this week looking at see-through trucks. What's going on with these see-through 18-wheelers?
Yeah, it's actually, this is one of those things, one of my favorite things to cover are shockingly simple uses of technology to solve a real problem. I think sometimes we get overly complicated. And one of my favorite things about this week is that we got one of those. So Samsung Argentina. Argentina happens to be the place with the most traffic accidents per capita in the world. And one of the reasons for that is that they have a lot of two-lane roads. And so one person an hour, unfortunately, dies in Argentina. And a huge percentage of those people die by trying to overtake on a two-lane road and ending up in a head-on collision. So Samsung in Argentina did something very clever. They put a small camera on the front of their truck, and they put a Samsung video display on the back of their truck. And so if you were following a Samsung truck right now, you can see what's in front of that truck. And they only have one prototype. They're only testing it now. So we have no data on exactly how many fatalities it could save. But they believe that if somebody could see through that truck they're trying to pass to the road in front of them, they're far, far more likely to know if a car is coming in the other direction, and more importantly, whether there's space for them to get back over onto the appropriate side of the road. And realistically, this is not an overly expensive or overly difficult thing to do to put on a truck. So I'm pretty excited by the idea.
Now, Larry, I've got to ask you, when you're driving around, what would you think about a truck where you pulled up behind it and you saw the road projected from the back end of the truck? I mean, is this something that's going to be distracting or helpful to most people?
Until I see it, I hate to get general on it, but I think I like the idea a lot. It happens to me a lot of times here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky with its two-lane roads where that exact situation happens. My usual technique is to peek out with the car before attempting to pass a truck. But if the display conveys the information, and I'm not sure about how good the vibration mount would be, it seems like a wonderful idea.
Well, now, I think the big question, while a lot of us are certain that 18-wheelers are an issue when it comes to road safety, you know, how far should this go down? I mean, should we see, you know, people hanging 50-inch HDTVs off the back of their big SUV or their boxy minivan?
Well, Dave, that's an interesting issue. I don't know what the answer to that is. The thing that I know that scared me the most about this was a statistic that said 98% of U.S. crashes that involved an 18-wheeler had at least one fatality. That number seemed outrageous to me. So whether it goes on the SUV or not, I'm not sure about. But putting it on the back of a truck, which is a revenue-generating thing, seems like a no-brainer. One place that people are trying this that's fascinating is airplanes. There is a company called Spike Aerospace that is building a supersonic corporate jet that is going to have no windows. And the reason it's going to have no windows is that a plane can be made much cheaper and easier, fly faster and with more fuel economy if you don't put a window on it. And so what they're doing is the same thing. They're putting cameras out and showing real-time views on screens on the inside of their airplane to give people that sense that they're not cooped up in the airplane. That, I think, is also a future we're going to see on airliners. So I think this idea is going to happen. It's going to spread. Whether it's on the back of your minivan, I'm not 100% sure.
Now, Larry, are you ready to get into an airplane where all you see is the televised picture of what's outside? I mean, it seems like it would be awfully easy for the airlines to calm passengers by keeping things looking sunny and bright, even while you're flying into, you know, Hurricane Bob somewhere.
Well, Kirk, here's the point about that. Even if you can see that you're about to hang into Hurricane Bob, what are you going to do about it? By sitting down, strapping your butt into the seat, you have transferred control of your lives to two drunken fools in the front. So, let them put happy face on there, you know, smiling sunsets. It won't matter. There may be an increased anxiety level from the passengers because they have learned that they can see outside. But when it comes down to it in a functional manner, what difference is it going to make?
It also solves a fun problem, which is how many times have you been on an airplane and the captain comes on and says, if you look out the left side of the aircraft, you can see the Grand Canyon. And all the people on the right are like, well, what am I looking at, right? What would be fun is if you had the ability to switch from the left side to the right side camera and actually see everything that the captain says that one side of the plane gets to see.
Or they could just drop the video screens that they already have and show you.
Yeah.
And everybody gets to look at the Grand Canyon every time you go over.
And even if you don't go over it, you can say, hey, we're flying over the Grand Canyon. And when you're actually flying over, you know, Utah.
we're flying from Nashville to Dubuque. Oh, look, there's the Grand Canyon.
I once talked to a flight attendant, and she said that whenever anybody asks what river they can see out the window, no matter where they're flying, she always says it's the Mississippi River. And she has never had one person ever dispute the fact that they were over the Mississippi River, even on flights like from Boston to Florida.
It is truly amazing. Well, I got a note from Sarah that she had an emergency come up and is not going to be able to join us. So before we leave, I want to spend just a couple of minutes on this Office of Personnel Management breach, the one that keeps on giving to us. And as I said, the numbers keep growing. And I'm wondering whether at the end of the day, there is going to be any private information left in the continental United States. Larry, I know that you have thought about this. How do you think we've seen the last of this story?
Oh, we may have seen the last of what they will let out about the story, because the scope, depth, and breadth of the incompetence that has been shown by our government in dealing with this is truly astounding. There have been absolutely no thought given to the possibility even that this kind of information could be accessed. I understand in some ways why that happened, because it's the government and they're working with COBOL, and there hasn't been a lot of COBOL crypto libraries, if any of them. Excuse me. But there has been almost an egregious lack of security going on. I can't remember where I read it, but one of the contractors to OPM that had root access to the system was actually a Chinese firm that was a front for the Chinese army. I'm not sure that it really, really, really looks horrible for OPM and other government agencies about considering this a kind of vulnerability. I mean, there was no, as far as I can tell, there was absolutely no data hygiene applied in any way, shape, or form.
Well, Dave, what do you think about this? Is I know that you are normally our voice of privacy. Does the scope of this breach essentially make everything we've said about the importance of privacy up to this point just that much more whistling in the wind?
Well, I don't know. The takeaway for me, I know this is not quite answering your question, but the takeaway for me here, I think, is actually that we have spent a huge percentage of our last 10 to 15 to 20 years thinking that we were economically and technologically superior, that the Cold War ended and we no longer were fighting an espionage war in that way, right? That we were no longer worried about the KGB taking our stuff, and that while we were fighting a war on terror, if you want to call it that, we didn't really have to worry in the same way about, the Taliban breaking into our system. They were guys living in caves, was the sort of story we were telling ourselves, right? And so we spent a huge amount of our tax dollars on how do we root out terror in our system? How do we actively infiltrate the public in an effort to stop terrorism? When in the process, we spent all of that money on figuring out how to take stuff from other people, we totally left the door open for other people to take our stuff.
I quite agree.
And that is disappointing, it's frightening, it's infuriating. And it's arrogant, and at the very least, I don't find China to be an enemy, but I do like to think that maybe we should not just let them take our stuff. We need to start treating China like an equal, technologically and economically speaking. And I don't think we ever did that. So what can I say about privacy? I think whether the government screwed up or not, every company seems to be screwing up. Privacy was already a problem. When Sarah came on a couple weeks ago, she pointed out that the Anthem breach gave up 98 million records. That's a third of the country in one breach that has nothing to do with the government, right? Even had the government perfectly kept every record, from a privacy point of view, we were already in trouble. So for me, the takeaway for the government is that we really just spent so much time stealing information from our own people that we forgot to protect ourselves, and that's kind of pathetic.
Well, I'm going to go just a little bit further on that. I go way back on some of these issues, and when my kids got into being online and doing computers, I literally drilled into their heads, anything you put online at any time is not private. Never will be, never can be. Someone else can always get it somehow. So I think a lot of the privacy that we are seeking is actually a consensual hallucination. It's not going to be there. If it goes through a node anywhere in the net, it can be taken. It's just a matter of if they want to take it. Look what the police have done with stingray operations. That's a great way to do it. Just spoof the cell phone towers and grab it from there.
It is indeed, and we certainly live in a heavily viewed world if we do anything electronic. Well, I'm afraid that runs us out of our time for this week. It's been a great conversation here, a great conversation in the online discussion.
Wait a minute. I'm not going to get a chance to do my tap dance. I perfected it.
Well, we always leave them wanting more. That's our motto here at Information Week Live, and I think your tap dance is something they'll just have to come back for on another day.
It really doesn't all play right. Well on the radio anyway, Larry. We really need to do that on video.
Right.
Well, speaking of such things, Larry, one of the things we always do here on Information Week Live is ask what you have coming up. What should people be looking for from you at Information Week Live in the week to come?
Google, speaking of privacy, will probably own a lot of your medical information, and they'll do it with your consent. I believe my thoughts on this will show up Monday on IW, where Google has got an approach here where they're showing enterprises how to do this sort of thing. They say they're going to get a baseline of human health when they're really going to collect massive amounts of data about what health is. They, again, say it's going to be for the greater good, but they're also establishing, along with as Apple with their research kit, by the way, how wearables can literally monitor you as well as a USB drive can monitor what you do with your car. So I'm going into that direction, at least for the beginning of the week.
All right. And for the latest information on what you're putting up, how can folks follow you on social media, the Tweety Pipes and other places?
Well, it's basically my name. If you just, and I know, for instance, V. Newman is actually following me on Twitter because I notice these things. A lot of people can get me on Twitter as at Larry Loeb, L-O-E-B as in boy. And if you search on my name on most social media, that's how I been registered for them.
Very good. We will certainly do that. And thank you for being with us here on Information Week Live.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kurt, anytime.
Dave, how about you? I know that you have a full plate most weeks. What's coming up from you on Information Week?
Well, first of all, I want to say four articles went up today. So check me out today. I did a lot of stuff that went up today. And I'm also really looking forward to Larry's stuff on Google, because I think it goes really nicely with Larry Page a couple years ago saying that Google was going to cure death, and I'm really fascinated by that.
They're trying it.
Yeah.
They're trying it.
But so I will be I'll have a story about the way millennials are changing customer service that I think should be pretty interesting. I'm also going to have a follow-up to Larry's story on Amazon Echo and Alexa, some things I'm hoping they're going to do when they open up their APIs, and I'm sure I'm going to have a lot of other fun stuff.
Is Billy Joel's daughter going to get a cut of all that action?
I'm not sure.
Well, Dave, now remind everybody where they can keep up with you on the social media.
Yeah, sure. On Twitter, at Geekend Dave, that's like weekend with a G, or as I say to my children, with a G. And you can find me on Information Week and on allanalytics.com.
Well, thank you very much for taking time out of what has obviously been a very, very busy day to be with us here on Information Week Live. As for me, in the coming week, I'm going to be looking at more programming stuff. I am indeed going to be looking for Fortran in today's IT world. I'm going to be looking at some Internet of Things stuff. Intel has some interesting products out there I'm going to be taking a look at. And while it won't hit the site next week, late in the week, I'm actually planning to run down to Orlando MakerBot, one of the largest presences in the 3D printing world, has a brand new CEO. He's invited me to come down to Orlando and spend some time with him. I'm going to
You're
do that.
You're just going to get the Mickey Mouse ears, Kurt. Admit it.
Well, everybody needs another pair. You can't have too many. So that is going to be an important byproduct of that trip. But that's all going to be coming up in Information Week. And for all of my information, you can find it by following me on Twitter at KG4GWA. Now, one thing I'm going to ask our audience's help with. We are starting a new project here at Information Week. Tell us what's in your IT Pro daily carry bag, whether it's a messenger bag, a backpack, an attaché case, or a footlocker with wheels. The thing that you carry with you to do your work every day. We'd love to know what it is and what you carry around with you in order to do your job. I did an article on that this week. And in addition, we've got a Flickr group where you can go in and show us your bag and tell us what's in it. I've just put a link into the chat here. Please take a moment, do that. Let us know what you carry with you and why. We will appreciate your help with all of that. Well, for Dave Wagner, Larry Loeb, and everyone here at Information Week Live, this is Kurt Franklin saying thanks very much for being with us. We will not see you next week because next week is July 3rd, which is the day before a national holiday here in the U.S., and a day that our company is taking off. So Dave and I will be working on our deep, dark tropical tans next week. I assume Larry will be doing something similar, and we hope that you are able to go out and enjoy a nice, long holiday weekend. We will be back in July with a full slate of Information Week Radio and lots of new stuff we're going to be telling you about. So, have a great weekend, a wonderful holiday. We'll see you in July. Thanks for being with us at Information Week Live.